The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
Welcome to the History of the World podcast magazine. Hello everyone, welcome to the History of the World podcast magazine. It's been a little while since I last published a podcast episode, and there's a reason for that as well. So I'm going to address that during this week's broadcast and talk to you about the state of the podcast. Now, I don't want you to get concerned. I know often when your favourite podcasts suddenly come up with a state of the podcast episode, it can be a bit daunting. You think, oh, does this mean that the podcast is winding down? Does this mean that it's had its day? Well, no, quite the contrary. This podcast is a very big part of my life, and I do want to just share with you some of the goings-on in my personal life and how it's affected the podcast and what we can expect from the future of the podcast. So I just want to address that with you today. But firstly, before we get to that, there is going to be some material that we present to you normally, as we do in the History of the World podcast magazine. And normally what we do, we go back over the history of the History of the World podcast and look back over its previous 5 years of existence and look at the episodes that were being published around this day in each of those years. Firstly, we're going to go back 5 years to when we were looking at Volume 1, the prehistoric episode, and one of the earliest individuals for who we have a story for, and it's Utzi the Iceman. So we're going to go back to our episode about metallurgy and find out about this strange human being who we discovered frozen in the Alps. In the year 3345 BCE, a baby boy was born in a farming community in modern-day Italy. Life was tough for the baby boy's community. As much as they did rely on the cereal crops that they were growing, it was clearly a tough life. Much as his group had a herd of domesticated goats, his elders still needed to show him how to hunt using flint-tipped arrows, which could be fired using a longbow, and using small woven nets to capture birds and rabbits. We'll call the boy Utzi. Utzi understood that by being a skilled hunter, not only could he catch his own meals, but that he could also manufacture his own clothing. He could use the hides of his larger captures, such as the sheepskin, to create a warm overcoat to help him survive those cold alpine winters. He knew that he could use the tendons and ligaments, the sinew of his prey, to stitch his clothing together. And he also knew that with his weaving skills, he could weave tough grasses together to create a warm lining inside his shoes, which would have been carefully made from deer skin attached to a bearskin sole. Utzi was a very capable young man, and when he left his home close to the modern city of Bolzano in modern-day Italy, and ventured north into Alpine territories to find his future. He was able to survive his adult life quite well, but soon that inescapable enemy of all humans would begin to catch up with Ötzi, the enemy being old age. Ötzi was now a man in his 40s, which was an achievement in itself during this period. Life was indeed taking its toll on Ötzi's body, which was not as young as it used to be. Ötzi's joints were becoming stiff and painful, but he did know people who knew methods to relieve the pain. They tried to help Ötzi by cutting the skin near the painful joints on his body and rubbing soot into the cuts. Such action would leave a permanent mark on Ötzi's body, similar to a tattoo, but this was no concern to him. All he knew that it was helping, and he kept going back over and over again for the pain relief of this treatment. Nonetheless, Ötzi was still struggling. His teeth had rotted away due to the intensity of the cereal grains from the bread in his diet, and this caused him gum disease, but this was just part of life for everybody. Ötzi had survived the winter, and the year was now 3300 BCE, the year of Ötzi's 45th birthday. The springtime was in full force, and although the nights would still be very cold, the weather was picking up. Competition for resources was hard, so despite Ötzi's aches and pains, he would still have to go out and look for resources and avoid others who would quite happily kill Ötzi to get to the resources first. Ötzi would eat a good meal of deer meat with bread before resting and setting out into the Alpine landscape on the modern Italy-Austria borderlands. Ötzi could not drink the milk of the domesticated goats due to the lactose content, so he had to drink the dirty water, which was not doing his health any favours as it was upsetting his stomach. The whipworms from the dirty water would cause stomach pains and diarrhoea, not to mention the ticks infesting his clothing, causing Ötzi bacterial infections that had made him feel extremely ill on more than one occasion during the last winter. However, Ötzi had to soldier on and look for resources. At some point during the day, Ötzi sustained a knife wound to his hand, but we can't be too sure if this was because he was attacked or whether this was an accident. Either way, it is clear that Ötzi did stop at some point to eat, and this time he ate some ibex meat, which may have been from one of the goats back at base. Ötzi may have taken this along with him in his bag pack, which contained everything he needed to survive, from tools for making fire to fungi, which he likely used for medicinal purposes, alongside some berries to keep him going. Eventually, on this fateful day, Ötzi ran out of luck. He was discovered by enemies who wanted Ötzi out of the way so that they could take whatever it was that Ötzi was after, all for themselves. He was struck in the back by an arrow and fell into the ice, where he bled to death. The remains of his body would be preserved in the ice for over 5,000 years. On the 19th of September 1991, Ötzi's remains were discovered in the Ötztal Alps, which is why we call him Ötzi. His tooth enamel, alongside palynology study, that is the study of dust and pollen grains, tells us where he grew up as a child and demonstrate his abrasive cereal grain rich diet.
The artifacts discovered alongside Ötzi's body, such as the flint dagger, the clothing, and the long bow and arrows, tell us a lot about the lifestyle and the fauna and flora that Ötzi lived alongside. Chemical analysis of his body tells us about his ailments and the presence of 61 tattoos near his joints suggests a method of treatment for his apparent arthritis. It also tells us about his last meals. Palynology of the most recent pollen on his body tell us what time of year he died, and his fingernails tell a story of periods of illness in his last few months alive. The wounds on his body tell us how he died. All of this scientific study allow me, your humble podcast host, to construct what may not be a completely accurate story, but nonetheless a reasonable one with all the evidence to hand. Why have I chosen now to tell Ötzi's story? Well, Ötzi is an example of a Chalcolithic man, a man who lived in the period when metallurgy had become a part of everyday life. We know this because Ötzi's remains, along with everything else mentioned, were accompanied by a copper-headed axe hafted onto a U wooden handle. Thanks to particles of copper found in Ötzi's hair, we have reason to believe that Ötzi manufactured his copper axe himself. So Ötzi was very likely a skilled Chalcolithic coppersmith.
Now, during the history of the Roman Empire, there are a lot of celebrated emperors who we talk about at length, but one of them who can often be overlooked is Vespasian, one of the Roman emperors who took over at a time of turbulence and basically settled the Roman Empire into a much more organized and financially responsible empire. And it was his reforms that made the Roman Empire great again, or certainly set it on the road to being great again. So let's go back 3 years ago. Sorry, four years ago? Yes, 4 years ago. No, I'm mistaken. It was 3 years ago. 2020, this episode was published. And we were talking about the Roman Empire in its earliest years. And this is the story of the Emperor Vespasian.
The imperial experiment had become progressively more unsuccessful over time since its inception back in 27 BCE, when Octavian was invited to become the first Roman emperor as Augustus. All eyes were now on Vespasian to demonstrate that imperial rule was better than republican rule. Vespasian was around 60 years of age when he became the Roman emperor. Vespasian was a vital part of the victories in Britannia in the year 43 under the rule of Emperor Claudius. Vespasian didn't immediately come to Rome because he was in the middle of dealing with a revolt in Judea, which had started back during the reign of Nero, while Vespasian was the Roman governor there. Many revolts had been instigated during the reign of Emperor Nero, mainly due to Nero acting completely irresponsibly with the Roman treasury. Nero was particularly ignorant of the feelings of the Judeans, ignoring the sanctity of their Jewish religion and hiking up the taxes. This sparked a rebellion which escalated into a military conflict between the Romans and a provisional Judean government which had been formed in the year 66. Vespasian was sent to deal with the rebellion, which saw the entire area become a place of political turmoil as local radical groups tried to take advantage of the conflict to assert their authority. Vespasian would be assisted by his son Titus, often called Titus, in trying to re-establish Roman rule of the province, and when Vespasian was promoted to becoming the emperor, Titus would take command and achieve victory over the Judeans in the year 70. Much of Jerusalem was destroyed, including the Second Temple. This can actually take us all the way back to episode 1 of this volume. When the Jews returned to Jerusalem back in the 6th century BCE, they rebuilt their sacred temple that was destroyed by the Babylonians earlier in the same century. Now their new temple had been destroyed by the Romans, but for the Romans, they had successfully put down this major rebellion. Another troublesome individual was Gaius Julius Civilis, who was known for his rebellious attitude among the Germanic tribes in the north of the empire. Generally, the Romans treated their Germanic subjects with a degree of respect, but Civilis had somehow managed to stir them into rebelling against Rome. And it could be on the grounds of higher taxation or obligatory conscription. Had the Germanic tribe of the Batavi and their allies achieved victory during this rebellion, then an independent Gallic Empire could have resulted. But this was not the outcome, as the Roman legions representing Vespasian's Roman Empire achieved supremacy by the year 70 and subjugated the Batavi once more. We have no record of the ultimate fate of Civilis. In hindsight, Vespasian had steered Rome through a difficult period with the right strategy. He initially ensured that all major rebellions had been suppressed before exercising necessary and strict financial control of the empire. This was needed in order to stabilise a weakened economy, which had been ruined by the reckless behaviour of Emperor Nero. Vespasian had also successfully brought the Roman legions into a much more unified army under the Roman banner. During the 60s, the Roman army had fragmented under the rule of their respective regional governors, which resulted in the civil conflicts of the year 69 and the year of the four emperors. On the whole, Vespasian can be described as a confident and responsible emperor. He showed respect to the Roman Senate and was therefore ticking all the boxes in a way that no other emperor had done since the reign of Augustus. His son Titus had performed well in Judea and was being prepared to be his father's successor. And so the foundations for a new Roman dynasty had been laid, the Flavian dynasty, so named after Vespasian. Full name, Titus Flavius Vespasianus. Some do cite Tiberius and Claudius as not being bad emperors, but in my opinion, this is really only because the Roman Empire did not suffer during the reigns of each of those emperors, as it did during the reigns of Caligula and Nero. The things that set Tiberius and Claudius aside from Augustus and Vespasian, for me, is their characters. Tiberius didn't have the charisma to be a successful emperor, and much work was done by others in his absence. Claudius was somewhat successful, but he made little effort to unite and involve the different political entities of Rome. What Rome gained from Vespasian was a man who was able to balance all of the different aspects of the Roman constitution in a way that had not been seen since the days of Augustus. Vespasian was frugal without being miserly, and he would instigate great building projects, but he would do so within the treasury's means. He would live a humble life without extravagance, which is in stark contrast to the last significant predecessor in the role, Nero. The stability of the empire on his death in the year 79 had not been so good since the reign of Claudius. Back in the early years of the podcast, we were fortunate enough to be discovered by a gentleman called Nick Barksdale, who ran a YouTube channel called The Study of Antiquity and the Middle Ages.
And Nick done a great deal to help us to get into the public eye, if you like. So he took a lot of episodes, turned them into YouTube videos. Maybe about 24 episodes were turned into YouTube videos. And I'm sure that it helped steer a lot of new listeners in our direction. He was one of the, I'd actually say the greatest benefactor of the History of the World podcast in its early years. And sadly, Nick is no longer with us. But while he was with us, he commissioned a couple of special episodes. One of them was an episode about the Mississippian culture. And of course, with the Mississippian culture, of course, a proud American, Nick was. He's identified some of the earliest known settlements in the United States that we can like sort of look at the excavations to. And one of those sites is Cahokia. So we're going to go back to the episode about the Mississippian culture and discover a little bit more about this site called Cahokia.
The American author Charles C. Mann describes the Mississippian culture's mound building as being akin to the medieval European cathedrals. The spiritual center point of a Mississippian settlement. Sometimes we would see a number of mounds of different sizes at one settlement. In other places, we can see large earthworks that represent geometric shapes or even animals such as serpents. But often we find that historians can argue about the age of such earthworks, as they are definitely difficult to age accurately. One place that we can categorically state is a definite and outstanding place of what we may refer to as Mississippian culture and mound building is a place called Cahokia.
Cahokia.
When talking of the Mississippian culture, we talk of sites such as Cahokia. For those of us who study ancient history, we are in awe of the constructions of the stone brick pyramids in Egypt and often neglect the ancient constructions of the Americas. For those of us who study the ancient history of the Americas, our attention is often captured by the giant rock structures in Mesoamerica, such as those at Teotihuacan, for example. If one were travelling along the Mississippi River 1,000 years ago, a wonderful sight would have emerged in the distance while travelling through the modern US state of Illinois. The largest man-made construction may have been taller than it is today due to the fact that it was built with earth rather than stone and may have slumped somewhat over the years. But the construction is comparable in size to the Pyramid of the Sun in Teotihuacan or the Great Pyramid of Giza in Egypt. Today, we call this construction Monk's Mound, which is a modern name. Where we know so little of Mississippian culture and Mississippian people, we can feel confident that the construction of such a sizable earthwork can demonstrate a society of a healthy and united population, very advanced in agriculture and trade. Monk's Mound is among a site of dozens of smaller mounds, which is collectively called Cahokia. Cahokia, once again, is a modern name. We don't know what the city was called in its prime. Projectile points and other artifacts have been excavated at this site, which demonstrate that there is likely to have been a settlement here from around the year 600 or 700, which in our timeline is earlier than Mississippian culture. So it may have been that the Mississippian mound builders were the descendants of these first settlers, as we have no reason not to believe that this site was continually occupied. Monk's Mound appears to be a ceremonial site with a wooden temple constructed at its apex, which certainly demonstrates a great spiritual essence existed here. The settlement was probably successfully supporting a growing population who would have been cultivating maize, among other crops, with maize being a staple crop of Mississippian peoples in general. The peoples would have constructed pit houses on sunken bases, not unlike the kind of basic houses created by the first semi-nomadic societies in Japan, for example. The Mississippi River would have been utilized as a bustling commercial route of transport, providing the similar value of wealth to the people that a modern American railroad or freeway might provide today. There is evidence of ceremonial burials at Cahokia that demonstrate a hierarchy which we should believe would naturally have to exist within such a large and successful society. It would make sense when we study world history and ancient populations that a leadership elite was necessary for the cohesiveness of the settled population, and we may assume a strong spiritual belief system, as is typical for most global ancient settlements. Ancient monuments such as circular wooden post arrangements may have plotted sunrises and possibly acted as calendars to aid in the organisation of crop management. At its peak, Cahokia would have had a population perhaps as large as 20,000 individuals, which makes it the largest settled population north of the ancient societies of Mesoamerica, with Monk's Mound being the largest man-made ancient building in this same area of the world. Palisades were constructed around the city, with guard towers demonstrating a requirement to defend the city from potential invasion when at its peak. There is also a somewhat typical consideration for the first ancient global urban centres.
Our final journey back in the history of the History of the World podcast takes us back to our episode last year when we were discussing the Crusades to the Holy Land. So this excerpt from a previous episode is all about one of the greatest characters of the Crusades, Saladin. Fatimid Egypt was in political turmoil, and the intervention of a Zengid embassy in order to restore order ultimately resulted in Sherko becoming the vizier within Fatimid Egypt. After Sherko's death, Saladin took over the role of vizier. But his ambitions were far higher, and he was in a great position to overpower the ineffective caliphate of the Fatimids. After the death of the Fatimid caliph, Al-Adid, at the young age of 20, Saladin moved to become the new Sultan of Egypt, establishing the Ayyubid ruling dynasty, replacing the Fatimids. As a Sunni Muslim, Saladin would move Egypt politically closer to the spiritual caliphate of the Abbasids in Baghdad. Saladin was a highly ambitious ruler, looking to bring as many of his neighbouring realms, both Christian and Muslim, under his rule. Saladin extended his overlordship along the Asian coast of the Red Sea down to the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula, before turning his attentions to the cities of the fragmenting Zengid dynasties. Firstly Damascus, before moving on to bring Aleppo, and then Mosul under his direction. Saladin was now in control of most of the land surrounding what remained of Outremer, and was now keen to turn his attention towards the Christian realms with his united Muslim armies. The united forces of Jerusalem, Tripoli and Antioch, alongside the Knights Templar and the Knights Hospitaller, were not enough for the sheer power of Saladin and the mighty Ayyubid Sultanate, and in 1187 Saladin crushed the Outremer armies at the Battle of Hattin. The Ayyubids suffered light casualties, whereas the Crusader states lost most of their military. This was a complete disaster for Outremer, but an incredible achievement for Saladin, who was now responsible for the glorious victory that had brought Jerusalem back under Muslim rule once more.
The Third Crusade.
Small pockets of Crusaders still had minor strongholds in the Levant, such as the city of Tyre, and the reaction in Europe was the instigation of a new crusade to the Holy Land. The English and French had been at war with each other, but had decided to stop their war in order to focus on the reconquest of Jerusalem. The English king, Henry II, died shortly after the Battle of Hattin, and so it would be the responsibility of his son, Richard I, romantically known as Richard the Lionheart, to step up to the mark. Richard's mother was Eleanor of Aquitaine, who before her marriage to Henry II had been married to the French king, Louis VII, of whom we will remember as one of the kings of the Second Crusade. Eleanor had actually accompanied Louis to the Holy Land on crusade. It may have been by an agreement with the French king Philip II, also known to history as Philip Augustus, that both Richard and Philip agreed to crusade at the same time, as it's possible that had one stayed in their own kingdom, the other might have had to have done too, to prevent the other from taking advantage of the absence. Both Philip and Richard were comparatively young and ambitious kings, but they would also be joined by the old and wise king of Germany, Frederick I, known to history as Frederick Barbarossa, the Italian word for red beard. These glorious European kings led to the subsequent Third Crusade, being known as the King's Crusade. By the sheer expense required to raise an army, those who were involved must have believed that there would be some sort of reward to them that would have extended beyond the wealth of the Holy Land. So the pious absolution of sins must have played an important part in the motivations for many high-standing nobles involved. The three kings travelled across Asia in order to do battle with Saladin's Ayyubids and take control of the city of Jerusalem once more. Firstly, the Crusaders would need to battle their way across Anatolia, and they would do so successfully. They would reach the Cilician territories to the south of Anatolia, and King Frederick Barbarossa of Germany would opt to try and cross the Salef River to head towards the Levant. And this proved to be a fatal mistake, as King Frederick fell from his horse and would unfortunately drown in the river. So now there were just two kings remaining, and certainly they were not particularly close friends. Philip arrived at the city of Acre, which is in the north of the modern country of Israel. The city was under siege by crusaders attempting to win it back from the Ayyubids when Philip arrived. And so Philip would put his military weight behind the effort. Richard arrived just over a month later, and with his military might, the city of Acre fell about a month afterwards. The Crusaders would now have a stronghold from which to launch an attack on Jerusalem. In the aftermath, Philip fell ill, which disabled him from continuing the assault, and on his recovery he felt obliged to return to France to attend to some pressing domestic affairs, leaving Richard feeling disgruntled that he had been abandoned with the job half finished. So from a large force led by three Western kings, it had now just boiled down to Richard the Lionheart to finish the job. Richard decided to take the remnants of his military towards the port city of Jaffa in order to secure it and have a stronghold from which to receive resources by which he could mount an attack on Jerusalem.
Saladin had decided to attack Richard's army before they reached Yaffa, however. And although Saladin had an air of invincibility due to his numerous military victories in the past, Richard staunchly defended his position and even pursued the Ayyubids from the battlefield. However, this battle, the Battle of Arsuf, had proven to be expensive for all sides involved in terms of exhaustion. Richard and his troops successfully reached Yaffa, but had to conclude that a conquest of Jerusalem was really no longer achievable. Richard was torn between the need to return home to Western Europe in order to tend to his domestic affairs, and the strong desire to not give up on the acquisition of Jerusalem by any means necessary. His desire was to build an army strong enough, but he would happily settle for a diplomatic solution. There were even discussions of a political marriage between Richard's sister Joan and Saladin's brother Al-Adil, but both sides were concerned that the religious identity of the marriage alliance would not be representative of the identity that either side wanted. Richard desperately wanted to attack Jerusalem again before circumstances would force him to return back to Western Europe. He set up camp again and once again drew the common sense conclusion that he did not have the military might to succeed. On returning to the Outremer-held territories on the coast, Saladin attempted to attack Richard's army once more, and once again Richard resisted. Richard and Saladin were well-matched adversaries, and their conflict with each other ended in a stalemate. A five-year truce was agreed, and although a Christian king of Jerusalem continued to exist in these coastal lands of Outremer, the city of Jerusalem itself remained in Muslim hands. Richard left Outremer in 1192. Saladin, exhausted from campaigning, retired to Damascus, where he died the following year from a fever in his mid-50s. Now, don't go anywhere, hot worlders. After this short interlude, we're going to have a state of the podcast address. So we're going to be telling you what you can expect from the future of the History of the World podcast and why things have changed a little bit in recent months.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, everyone, now the bit that some of you will have been eagerly anticipating and waiting for is the state of the podcast. Now, of course, when the History of the World podcast started out, it was a very good and convenient weekly podcast. It used to always come out on a Saturday night stroke Sunday morning, and that did change with time. And those times that I couldn't write a full episode, we used to have unscripted episodes, which have since become History of the World podcast magazine episodes. Now, in recent months, I've not been able to keep up with the weekly schedule, and in some cases I was publishing maybe episodes late. And on some weeks, which hasn't been a case for the podcast before, I've been publishing no episode at all. So I just wanted to tell you exactly why that's the case and what you can expect from the History of the World podcast going forward. So more in recent months, my lifestyle has changed considerably. And it's due to some sort of health issues, nothing serious, but those sort of things that happen as you get older, let's say. I've been to see a dietitian, and I'm now doing a lot more exercise. I'm going to the gym regularly, and I'm preparing a lot more of my meals. So also, like, when I go to work, I'm actually taking a prepared lunch with me, which is something I didn't used to do. I used to just sort of work the day without really eating and worry about eating when I come home. So when I see the dietitian, of course, I said, no, you can't do that. So a lot of those things I'm sort of doing are taking up my personal time, leaving me less time to study. At my place of work, I work at an airport, so as you can imagine, it's non-stop at a major city airport. And as such, in the nature of my work, I've been doing a lot more irregular shift patterns than I'm used to doing in recent years. And of course, that sort of has an impact on your sleeping patterns, and I find sometimes I'm coming home of the evening and I'm maybe too tired to study after I've done everything that I need to do when I get home. So it's just really my life has changed somewhat, and it's not been too conducive to the studying element, the studying and writing element of the podcast. So I also have plans over the course of the next year to get married and move property, which certainly isn't going to help my spare time. So a lot is going on in my life. However, one thing I will say is that I very much bonded to this podcast, and thanks to all you kind people who do contribute towards the podcast, it does afford me a bit in the way of options going forward. So I also want this podcast to ultimately be my future, or the platform to something else. And so I'm hoping at some point it may even replace my need to work full time. But only time can tell there. So in terms of my dedication to the podcast, that is certainly not in question. So just because I've been slacking off lately, it doesn't mean that I'm planning to wind down and maybe give up on the podcast. So I just want to give you that assurance. What I thought might be a more realistic schedule for the podcast going forward is to maybe publish a new episode every 2 weeks and intersperse that with a magazine episode every other week. So that is going to be my initial plan going forward. So hopefully we can get back into a weekly routine, but the new material is not going to be as forthcoming as maybe it was in the past. Now, I do want to get back to a much more regular schedule, because ultimately the value of the History of the World podcast is getting to the end of the entire story. And of course, if I'm publishing new material bi-weekly, of course that doubles the life span of the podcast and sort of doubles the amount of time that I anticipate getting to the end of the project. So I'm going to be considerably greyer than I might have originally thought I would be. So it's still important for me to have a game plan that I can stick to, but as I'm sure you can understand how some of the things that I've mentioned can almost get in the way of that. I do have some time off work in mid-November. The reason why I haven't been publishing too many podcasts in October is because I was out of the country as well, so that's my excuse for not publishing anything for the last 2.5 weeks. But then in mid-November, I'm looking to actually sit down and distribute some of the goodies that have been earned by History of the World podcast Illuminati members. So that's something that anyone who's been waiting any length of time for their mugs, for their t-shirts, hopefully I can get them out to you during November. In terms of going forward, so not a lot that I've said is really positive about the podcast, but thanks to
the History of the World podcast Illuminati members, and thanks to the fact that I can now advertise on the podcast, gives me a lot more options in terms of what I can do and some of the sacrifices that I can make. So in terms of my working week, I'm negotiating maybe to reduce my working week so that I can give more time to the podcast. So it's not all negative in terms of my devotion to the podcast and the amount of time I'm able to devote to the podcast. There might be things that I can do to adjust that balance and maybe give myself more time to devote back to the podcast and maybe get it back to a more regular schedule. But that is the honest truth about the state of the podcast. And I do sincerely thank you for your time in listening to this. And I also thank you for your patience. Sometimes if you enjoy something, it can be rather disappointing if it seems like the foot's come off the accelerator a little bit, or you're not getting as much new material as you might hope for. So I do sincerely apologise for any frustrations caused by what you might label as my tardiness. But believe me, there's an absolute desire to get this podcast back into a much more regular routine. So thank you so much for all your patience. Anyway, I'm not going to go into listener messages and reviews this week just because of the length of the podcast. But there is plenty to update you on next time. And it may be another magazine episode, but I'm still writing. I'm in the process of writing the next episode on Japan. So look forward to that in the coming weeks. Anyway, thank you so much for listening, and be good.
The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler. Please consider making a financial contribution by going to the historyoftheworldpodcast.com website and clicking on the Patreon link. Email the show at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. And don't forget to join our social media at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. See you next time.